And thank you all for reading tonight. And thank you, Lisa LaQuisha, for your service for posting all that. As you guys know, for those who are not initiated, we do every week, every month, we do a step, a tradition, living clean reading. If there are five Mondays in the month, we do a just for today reading. And on the last Monday of the month, we get a speaker. And today we have a speaker who I've had the pleasure of having even though we have not met face to face yet, there's still time. We have kept a dialogue going for a while, and I haven't talked to him in a few days, so this is because of craziness in my life. But I know this guy has really worked incredibly hard on his recovery and gone through a lot of different things to stick around here. And I'm so grateful that he is still with in my life, as well as part of the program of Narcotics Anonymous. So I'm going to turn it over to Ralph to share his experience, strength, and hope with us. And you can speak as if you could speak for anywhere between 30 to 35 minutes, it'd be really wonderful. And it's yours, Ralph. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks. Hello, Ralph.
Just unmute yourself to share, Rifle. Ralph.
Thank you very much. That would help. Good evening, everyone. Sorry, it's a great privilege to be here, and I'm a grateful recovering addict, and I'll do
Hi,
my best.
Ralph. Hi, Ralph.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Ralph.
30 to 35 minutes. Whoa. Okay. Where shall I start? I suppose at the beginning, really. I was born in the summer of 66. A insecure, fearful mother who taught me very quickly that the world is a terrifyingly bad place, and an abusive, coercive, alcoholic father who, to quote my mum, hated you from the moment he first saw you. I was an oversensitive, insecure child. I'm not sure how much of that has changed. We're working on it. But for instance, my first day at school, I was terrified to the point where I managed to wet myself. And sure enough, I got punished when I got home, with a belt that he kept on the back of the bedroom door. That was his preferred treatment of me. I was the middle child, ultimately, of three. My older sister had quite severe learning difficulties, and my younger sister was his pretty little princess. So I was kind of caught in the middle. I was largely ignored by dad and cotton-wooled by my mum. And she'd be loving to me when he wasn't there and say the most amazing supportive things. And then the minute he turned up and he was cold and distant, she went very quiet. And it left me really feeling confused and mistrusting of people. I didn't know when people said they loved me, if they did or if they didn't, what was going on. Anyway, I made it through infant school, and I got to junior school being bullied constantly. I was always interested in drawing and reading and, the arts, I suppose. And I ended up, I don't remember this, but I was taken out of that school one day when after a particularly heavy bullying session. I was caught being bricked. They were doing building works at the junior school, and I was in a corner with a bunch of kids throwing bricks at me. So I was taken out of that school and had to find another school. I sat two interviews and two exams, and was finally accepted at a St. Peter's, which was a private Catholic boys' school. Yeah, I got in, and it was the only time that I can ever remember him saying anything positive to me when he said, "Yeah, well done. I'm proud that you got in because your cousin Gary didn't. That's one up on them." That was it. He was jealous. He was a jealous, bitter, resentful, and violent man, and had physical violence with everybody, every member of our extended family, and indeed every neighbor of every house that we ever lived in. We lived in six different houses, and there was always they were always being punched, and it was horrible. Anyway, I went to St. Peter's, which was great. That was my escapism. It was a superb school in all areas. Had five rugby pitches, four football pitches, tennis courts, athletics tracks, an Olympic-sized swimming pool, diving pools. The sportiest I ever got, I think, was tiddlywinks. So that didn't really apply to me, but I was interested in the arts, and it had a beautiful, purpose-built theatre that seated 1,100. It had an orchestra pit, and it was bigger than some of the theatres in Bournemouth. And I loved it there. It had an arts block that was six stories high, and yeah, I made friends there for the first time ever. Yeah, that was school really. My parents had hotels, so I was taught very at a very young age, rather like a trained monkey, how to behave in front of people. I was paraded out, as were my sisters, when he deemed it appropriate. It wasn't, they didn't have big hotels, but it was like, I don't know, 20 to 30 bedroom hotels. But I learned quickly how to put on a different face in different situations. And that helped me as I developed my love of drama. I was in all the school plays. I did all the scene painting and helped with costumes and just adored it. Dad came to only one of those plays, and sat in the second row and managed to fall asleep and snore through the entire production, which was deeply embarrassing, and I got ribbed mercilessly by my friends. Mum had her own struggles. She was a very nervous woman. She had got pregnant. She'd broken up with the love of her life, met my dad, fell pregnant on a one-night stand, ran off, realized her mistakes, ran off, and eloped with her ex. But my father spoke to her father, and they basically bullied her into having annulling that marriage and marrying my dad. So she was in a marriage that she wasn't really happy with at all. I remember when I was coming home from school about 12, and I walked up the driveway, and there was an ambulance there. Mum was on a gurney being put into the back of it, and I ran up to Dad and said, "What's happening? What's wrong with Mum? What's wrong with Mum?" And he said, "Your Mum's tried to kill herself because you're just not doing well enough at school, and she's deeply embarrassed, and she can't cope with it anymore." And it wasn't until I was 19, in a conversation with my mum, that I found out that yes, she tried to kill herself, but it was because my dad had been shagging the au pair for the last 5 years, in their bed. So that, yeah, I was blamed for not doing well enough at school. He kept an unlicensed gun at home, which he used on numerous occasions if I argued or if I was disobedient. It was often pulled out on me, and things like, "Oh, best thing I could just blow your pathetic little brains out," or "Be careful, you might wake up dead," or on one occasion, which in actual fact was the hardest to hear, was, "I'm going to go and kill myself now. I'm going to go drive out to the forest and kill myself, but not before I've left a note in the car saying that it's all your fault before I do it." and then watching him drive off with his gun. That was horrible. His brother was a known paedophile, and yet he made him my godfather, which was interesting because he was the most homophobic, racist, bigoted man I have ever met. I don't think I can imagine anybody more vehement and strong in their views. And when I eventually told him about Uncle Peter, he just told me to never mention it again, and next time I manned up. Sexually, I had girlfriends from a very young age, and I lost my virginity at the age of 12 to a girl who was 18, who was then Miss Bournemouth, at a party underneath the table. But it was very kind of what's the word? Unpleasant all round, really, I suppose. But it started a bizarre interest and relationship with sex. He found a porno mag under my bed when I was 14 and beat me, but then started presenting me every month with a magazine of his choosing. So he even controlled or wanted to control my use of sexual imagery. My mum was used to send really weird. I can remember going to the beach. We lived in the New Forest in Bournemouth between the two, and I'm going to the beach once, and my mum commenting on how big my package was getting in my Speedos, which was just excruciating. There were lots of little comments like that. I think I didn't really ha understand. It was all very unnatural, I think. Anyway, Dad was also a retained fireman, doing his bit, being the hero, which he loved. But then he had an accident whilst travelling to Shout one day and did his back in, which saw him in hospital for 9 months. He then decided to sue Hampshire Fire Brigade, and it was a massive court case. He lost, so they lost everything. His mum had to sell her house, and they got a place together, and it was just awful the way that he treated her. He treated his mother the way that he treated my older sister, which is kind of like, the only way I can describe it, it's a bit like a dog. Like my sister used to come in and say something. People watch television, and she'd come in from her room, and he'd just say, "Oh, shut up, go to your room," before she'd even said anything. And he used to say similar things to his mother, which I used to get really upset about, and I used to try to defend them, but it never really was successful. And Mum told me actually, latterly, that in her life, told me that she tried leaving him 4 times, but that he had convinced her that either she wouldn't be able to cope with Deanna and my younger sister and myself without him, or that she believed that she was too afraid to leave us with him, so she stayed. Anyway, I finished school. I got my eight. O levels as it was then, a couple of CSEs. I did my A levels. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I applied to RADA, and I got in, but Dad refused. At that time, it was part parent, part grant thing, and he wouldn't pay for the makeup of the grant, so I couldn't go. But he would pay for me to go to art school. So I did a foundation course in art in Bournemouth and really enjoyed it. Then had to apply to think about which degree show I was or degree I was going to do, and I had no idea. Painting told me I should be doing fine art painting. Graphics said I should do graphics. People were saying I didn't know which way to turn. In the end, the two tutors of the fashion and textiles department was a couple called Robert Wingrove and Tracy Leach, and they were kind of the young enfant terrible of fashion. They'd graduated from St. Martin's and were very kind of cool at the time. And so at the last minute, I applied to St. Martin's and I got such a rollicking from my course tutor because I'd wasted my application. And it was explained to me, look at the four other people that applied and their work is absolutely what St. Martin's are looking for, and you've just blown it with a waste. And I was the only one to get in. So I got into St. Martin's and I loved it there doing textiles and fashion. And I have to be honest that after about 6 months, though, of spending time with my peers, and I learned that it was all about how many times you went to the Mud Club and how friendly you were with Lee Bowery. And basically they were just wanky people. And much as I loved clothes, the prospect of actually working as a designer independently and being successful to any degree is so slim. Most of the people I know who are still in fashion and who I was at St. Martin's with actually ended up going and working for the design department at Marks and Spencer's or such like. And I didn't want that. So I plucked up my courage, and at the end of my first year, I went to the head of course, who at that time was a woman called Lydia Kemeny, who was a really fierce woman, brilliant, but quite terrifying. And I told her that I thought that perhaps it wasn't for me and that I needed to leave. And she told me that she didn't think I should. And I said, I don't know what to say. And she's brilliantly and so generously said to me, I've done this once before, Ralph. I'll give you a year. I'll hold your place open for a year. So if you go and you decide you want to come back, there's a place for you. Which was just having somebody like that show belief in me like that was something I'd never really experienced. Anyway, I did leave and I went and applied to Wimbledon School of Art to do theatre and costume design. And I was lucky enough to get in there. So I did my degree there, and was drawn more to the clothes and the costumes. Ultimately, and at my degree show, I was fortunate enough to be offered a job as an assistant designer, a costume designer down in Bristol. So I came down to Bristol, I started working, and then they were doing interviews in London, and I applied and was told you won't get in because you haven't got enough experience. And I got in there. And so I started working as a costume designer for television and film, which lasted me for 33 years, mostly television. And I was in demand and I really enjoyed it. I think without losing track here, I'd met and fallen in love with a girl, Annette, and I'd come to London, and after a while I asked her to come and join me, and she did. To which again, Dad's comment was, "You're not a real man if you can't do it on your own." We ignored that, and we were happy, blissfully happy. I was working as a designer, and we got married, and it was all great. And career continued to do well. She had five miscarriages, unfortunately, and then we had a baby girl, which is brilliant, and then another miscarriage, and then we had a baby boy. But 3 weeks before Finn was born, my son, I was working down in Wales, working on a show And we were doing a scene, we were due to do a scene in a nightclub in Cardiff, and the director had said to me, "You must go and do a recce of that club because it's very specific. Oceania, Cardiff is not like anywhere else in the country." So we were finished filming, and I went on my own and did a recce, or to do a recce, and got there quite early. So I went into a pub, had a drink, went to the loo, and was followed in and had a chain flung around my neck, pulled into a cubicle, and was raped by two guys very violently, involving a knife. And their part, I never saw their faces. Their parting words to me were, "You've just been posed up, mate." And I didn't know what that meant, didn't have a clue. I was told to stay there for 2 minutes, and had the door go, and I stayed there for 2 minutes, sort of sobbing with my face, scared and not knowing what was going on. Managed to get myself together and sort of staggered out. I never did that recce. I managed, I don't know how, to get into my car and drive back to the hotel where the whole crew were sat in the bar beckoning me to join. I went straight upstairs, and I spent the whole night in and out of scalding baths, burning my clothes in a tired little metal waste paper bin with the window open. And phoned my assistant and said I had a terrible tummy bug the next day. And I stayed there for 3 days. And after 3 days, I thought, right, I better get on with it then. So I got myself together and went back to work. I didn't feel I could tell anyone because our baby was due to be born in 3 weeks, and Annette was struggling alone at home with our daughter and the upcoming birth. So I didn't talk to anyone about it. I did seroconvert pretty quickly, and anyway, Finn was born. He was healthy. I went for tests at the doctor's and was told, "Yes, you have AIDS." And I sort of fell apart, really. I managed, because I had to go back to work, but I fell into the thing that I'd avoided up until that point, which was cocaine use. It was everywhere in the industry. I started losing myself in that. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I wanted. Anyway, yeah, I did start on treatment after a while. And I've now been hunky-dory for years. Take my meds. That's all good. Issues with dad continued on and out, on and off. My health continued to deteriorate. I was misprescribed a medication that then caused a full adrenal collapse, to be resuscitated. And there's been numerous, I've now got now six critical health conditions. But I did manage to keep working for a while. Ultimately, though, I did have a major breakdown. That's not until I'd had five attempts at suicide, all of which were totally genuine, and all of which I still don't know how they didn't work. I mean, I won't go into detail because it might be triggering, but yeah, I did have a major breakdown and suddenly announced that I was gay. Weirdly, as it sounds, I had been oblivious of the fact until then, and subsequently, I've been told by a psychologist that it can happen if you've got a particularly abusive, homophobic parent. Your subconscious can just not allow you to go there. And apparently, the rape had opened up those doors. And so I suddenly blurted out that I was gay. And, my wife and my kids were and remain amazing. They've done nothing but be supportive. And so I don't understand why then, having decided that I had to move out, my wife's saying, you need to go off and be the gay man you are. You know, I want you to be happy. I want you to live life as your authentic self. So I moved out, and within a very short period of time, I was introduced to the chemsex scene, and drugs then started stealing my life. I don't know how I'm doing for time here. Am I doing all right? Well, how long have I got, Michael? Are you there? No.
Yeah, you have about 10, 15, you can go for about 10, 15 minutes. So thank you.
I then managed to get myself together enough and went and did a job working in Hungary, in Budapest. While I was there, I woke up one night in agony. I couldn't move my legs. I had to call. Thankfully, my mobile phone was by my side, so I called the production secretary, and they had to come and break down the apartment door. And I was told that if I didn't have an operation within 4 hours, that I'd be unable to walk. So they would whisk me off in this ambulance to this hotel, this hospital in Budapest, which is the worst hospital in Hungary. And my God, was it! I woke up the next day still in pain. My sheets were covered in blood. The nurses belled. There were four of us in a room with sort of tiled, cracked tiled walls, and there was snots, dried snot splattered up the walls. And the guy next to me was 90, had a nappy on that had come off and was just incontinent. Stench was horrific. The guy opposite me spoke a bit of English, and said that that's all they do is they change his nappy once a day and leave him. So I managed to speak to production, got out of there, but and was flown back to the UK, having to leave the job, along with my files and my MRI scans and everything they'd done. But when I got back to the UK, it turned out that they had messed up the operation, and I now had keloid scarring going around the nerves that run up the centre of my spinal cord, and they couldn't operate because, or they can't operate because it's too intertwined. So I've got some pain with that. I got to a point where I was able to sort of walk on two sticks. Met a guy who I thought was lovely. Saw him for several months, and then was persuaded to go and move down to Gloucester with him. And I did that. And I'd been here for about 3 days when things started to change, and my bank cards went missing, and my passport went missing. And then all my medication went missing, and he wouldn't give it to me. And things started getting violent, and it spiraled again. And he used to, I got to the stage where I just let him. He used to tie me up and then inject me with drugs, and got a kick out of it. It got to the point where the police, I had to call the police one day, and I was told that I had to make myself homeless, get out there and then, because this guy, to quote, is known to us and he's dangerous. So I did. I got out with my car full of stuff and was homeless for 5 months, which was very leveling. I then, my parents came to visit at some point, and the kids had come up. It was an Easter weekend, and we were all going to meet at my place. They came up, and my dad turned up and was patently drunk, and he continued to drink and then started getting abusive about. That must have been awful for me being married to Annette, because she's not a small girl, and it must have been like going out with an elephant on my arm. Said that we always thought you'd leave Annette anyway because you'd want someone that looks attractive. Your kids are spoilt little fuckers. All this kind of stuff. I got to the point where I just told him to get out. Get out of my home. I'm not having that. And as he walked out, he said, I'm going to make sure you never get any money from us when we die. And I said, I've never wanted any money from you. I just wanted a father, but I didn't get that. The result of that was that he stopped me seeing my mum for 10 years. Every time he phoned up, if I phoned up, he would always answer the phone, put the phone down. I learned from my sister latterly that every birthday present or flowers or anything that I sent down was burned and thrown away. My younger sister would tell me where my mum was, which home she was in, because I learned from somebody in the family that she was now in a home because she had vascular dementia. But I did, with the help of Devon Social Services, where they now lived, managed to find out where she lived and managed to see her twice before she died. It's been a bit of a journey, really. I then came and met another guy, Mr. Fall in Love here, and really, really liked this guy, and was going home to London for the weekend to see the family. And en route, I got a call from somebody that I used to use with, and I made a detour there. The call of drugs was so strong, and spent the night being disgusting. But woke up at 5 o'clock when I realized that I didn't know where my phone was, and then discovered that it was on my bed. On the bed, I'd been lying on it and had dialed my partner's number, and he'd heard everything. So the relationship was over. And I don't think I've ever been so low and so lost. I then thought, well, maybe, just maybe, I do have a problem with drugs. And the realization that hit me hardest was the fact that I always said my kids are the most important thing in my life. And I suddenly realized that I had diverted from seeing them and I had not put them first. So I ended up going to my first NA meeting. I was terrified. I thought, I'm not like them. I'm not a drug addict. Oh my God, am I an addict? So I walked into the room, terrified, physically shaking, and yet was met by, a room of broken people. But they were honest people, and they were kind people, and they were authentic people. And I sat there and I listened. And I had coffee afterwards and made polite chit chat and left. And the next week I went back. And then I went back the week after that. And I don't know why. I can't say it was giving me this or it was giving me that, but there was something that kept bringing me back. I had one lapse one night. One stupid night where I experienced psychosis, which scared the hell out of me to such an extent that I have never even thought about using since, really. There's been a couple of moments, really difficult moments, but it's just been a fleeting thought. But yeah, I went back and I did my best to work the program, I do service. I had a great sponsor. I'm doing the steps, and slowly, very, very slowly, I'm peeling back the layers, and I'm learning to let go of the masks and the behaviors that had so brilliantly hidden who I really am. And it is scary, and it's emotional, and I fail regularly to varying degrees in terms of what I would like to be achieving. And I still have numerous chronic health issues that do make it very difficult at times. But I have to say, it's proving proven to be the single most rewarding and life-affirming thing that I've ever done. I'm even starting to think that maybe I might be an okay human being after all. So if I can do, if it can do all that for me, then I know it can certainly work for anyone else. And I do believe you just have to be open-mindedness, open-minded, honest, and willing, and do what's suggested. And perhaps most importantly, keep coming back, because it's changing my life for the better. And I hope and pray that it could change everyone's life in the same way. So I'm going to leave it there, and thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you
Thank
very
you,
much,
Ralph.
Ralph.
Ralph, that was beautiful.
So glad
Thank
to
you, Ralph.
hear you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph.
Wonderful share, Ralph. Wow. I was hanging on every word. And you've come a long way, baby, to say the least. Yeah. The one thing I really honed on to was going to my first meeting. One thing I can remember really distinctly was how happy everybody was and how fucking miserable I was. Pardon my French. But they welcomed me. They told me to keep coming back. And I will admit it didn't stick stick on my first meeting, but when I got loaded 2 weeks later, it stuck with me. And I came back and I've been here ever since. And you know what? I'm still learning how to navigate through these choppy waters called recovery. But you know what? As you said before, it's so fucking worthwhile. So worthwhile to come into these rooms. And I just recently realized I'm an introvert. So for me to go to a online to face-to-face meeting takes a lot of energy for me. That's why I love the online meetings, but it's also helped me get along with other people at face-to-face meetings. So I'm grateful to be, you know what? I'm so grateful that I'm here and I heard you share. It was lovely. And I know your trajectory and you're just going up and up. And it's just lovely to watch. I mean, watch you grow. We're in distance, but definitely hear the growth coming from you, and well done you. And now this is your time to share. We have this meeting ends at 8:30, so feel free to share as much as you will. Please be cognizant of the time, but if you need to share a little bit longer, maybe 5 minutes would be good. I want to hear everyone share what they need to share. And you can talk about what Ralph shared or anything else that's coming into your recovery. Thank you so very much again, Ralph, for your share. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And the floor is yours. Oh, wait, let's do the clean time countdown first, and then we'll get to the shares. As part of this, part of our format of this meeting, we'll celebrate clean time with claps and virtual hugs. Is there anyone celebrating clean time milestone of today or this week of multiple years? Of 18 months, of 1 year, of 9 months, of 6 months, of 90 days, or 60 days, or 30 days. Is there anybody in the first 29 days of recovery or at their first meeting back from a relapse, desiring a new way of life? Please keep coming back, everyone. And I love this line. Remember, we are people with the disease of addiction. We must abstain from all drugs in order to recover. So, just to let you know, you can have a virtual key tag image for your clean time if you go to the links at the bottom of our website. And if you are in an isolated area, would like to get a key ring, please send your name, address, and clean date to the number the, to the website shown here, and we will get you one as soon as possible. Now it's time for your shares, everybody.